You're listening to St. PedeX Season 2. This episode is brought to you by the St. Petersburg Foundation. The St. Petersburg Foundation builds capacity at the organizational and community levels to increase social impact. For more information, visit stpete.foundation. That's stpete.foundation. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me today on SPX is Dr. Helen Levine. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We don't get a ton into bios, but did a lot of work in advocacy for USF and then Rick Baker before that, and then some other advocacy work before that, and recently retired. So congratulations on a very successful career.
I'm delighted to have had such a fabulous career making a difference to folks in all sorts of organizations. And before joining Mayor Baker, I was over in Hillsborough County government, where I really cut my teeth.
Mr. Carl.
Fred Carl was the revered county administrator, and then I got to work with another fabulous county administrator, a guy named Dan Clayman. And those two folks, we got a lot of good stuff done. We had a great board of county commissioners. But that's where I started my advocacy career, with Fred Carl offered me that job.
Wonderful. And as I've perused the many accolades and many tributes and the love that has been thrown out there for you as you retired, one of the common themes was your ability to work with everybody. And, you know, with our little news endeavor, the catalyst, you know, our mantra is our greatest asset is that we keep the most minds open to us at all times. And sometimes I find that that takes sacrifices in the micro to keep that macro goal going. So looking back, can you talk about how important that was and how intentional you were about that and potentially any sacrifices you had to make to do that?
So first, a big shout out to Catalyst. You guys are making a difference in the community, and that kind of value, I think, gets distributed by everybody who reads and listens to all of your products. I think it's so important. So for me, I grew up in a Jewish liberal home, but the key at the dining room table and for all the organizations that my parents volunteered in, it was about sharing and it was about listening. Both my parents are social workers. I have an undergraduate degree in social work. And I just think the listening is where it all begins. So for me, does it really matter what your partisanship is or what you think? There's usually something we can connect on. And I would focus on that. And it has served me well professionally, but it's also served me well personally. So there's lots of joy in finding a way to talk to people. And people are so interesting, Joe.
And as you, yes, they are very interesting. That's one of the benefits of the job.
Yes, yes, yes.
But as you get deeper into issues, listening lays the framework and sets the tone. And, you know, I would probably guess that sometimes the listening was more one way than others. You know, what comes next? You then, you know, with the information you've garnered from listening, you know, at some point it comes down to we feel this way, another person feels that way. So then how do you take that philosophy to the next level?
So I have worked in the public sector, so I always knew who my client was. And so in my Hillsborough County days, my friends laughed. We did three major sports initiatives. First, we did hockey. Then we did George Steinbrenner for spring training. And then we did the Bucks. My friends laughed because I didn't know the difference between a baseball and a hockey puck. And I didn't think that it mattered to have the Yankees in Tampa. I was wrong. But that was my task. My task was to help fund each of those initiatives. Each of those deals was totally different. So early in my career, I got to learn the power of sports, this power of franchises. I would not have chosen those assignments,
right,
but that is what the Board of County Commissioners wanted me to go do. So I think that knowing who your client is and candidly coming to work every day, knowing who your client is and what they want,
right,
gives me the focus. And if I could not be comfortable with some of those decisions, they were elected, I was not, then I needed to go find other work. But I think that that notion of not about me, about the client, and what is their direction. And then you have to find the places where you can agree that are acceptable to the policymakers and are, you know, various policymakers, whether it's the Board of County Commissioners, Mayor Baker, or the legislature, or the governor. So I think it's really threading that needle. Each project is different, though the intent has to be the same.
Got it. And, you know, as you engaged with folks to do this work, did you find that, you know, as you moving in with the listening theme, did you find that as you listened to them, obviously your hope was they would listen to you, or at the very least, you could take what you learned from listening to them to help you do your job better. Did you quickly see which of those two paths you were going to have to go down? And, you know, did you hope, obviously, that they would open up and listen back? And then sometimes they wouldn't. And then
just like every place, lots of different personalities. Some folks you can be really direct with and just say, you know, it won't work and this is why.
Right.
And that they'll be responsive. Others, it's a lot of triangulation. So if somebody won't listen to me, then I find somebody who they will listen to and I go make my pitch there. I think that the good policymakers, the good elected officials want to know more. Most of them are curious, and that's why they're in the business, some more so than others. But I also think that you start with, where are you? I think while the lobbying industry is maligned, I think that it's a mistake. I think that what lobbyists, good lobbyists, ethical lobbyists do is provide information and facts. I think that's magnified. My career was so long, I remember when there were not term limits.
Right.
So, but I think with term limits, even more so, the members have a quick learning curve. They're assigned to committees they may or may not know about. So really the lobbyists who are in it for the right reasons, a lot of it is education and understanding how it all works together. So some of it is teaching, and some of it is helping them make the connections to the community, whether it's about higher ed or local government. But I think you have to really appreciate that, particularly the folks in Tallahassee. It's not a full-time job. It's pretty intense. Most of them are on lots of committees. So working with them and working both with the aides, who are sometimes totally, totally not acknowledged or valued, and also working with the professional staff. One of the things about Florida is that they actually do have a professional legislative staff. That is not the case in every state. And these are some of the smartest, most capable folks who are deep, deep experts in their subject area. So working with them, while they may be experts in higher education, they may not have ever worked on a campus. It's different. So just trying to make those connections, providing lots of facts and providing sometimes just a nudge of call your best friend. So knowing who connects with who in the community is also a big asset.
Right. And I think that, you know, listening and the network, you know, that all kind of falls back onto trust, which is just interesting as you sort of lay that over the idea of the negative view of lobbying. And it's funny because we get this all the time where people will say, you know, come out with this idea. And more often than not, the first response to the idea is not about the idea. It's about the motivation behind the idea. You know, oh, this person was paid by a think tank to say that. I always have thought, well, so what? I mean, it makes their motivation clear. But then the presumption is that, you know, they're not just trying to put forth their perspective. They're trying to bend the truth or bend stats to their will.
I'm smiling only because my friend who went to undergraduate school with me, Dominic Calabro, runs Tax Watch. Mm-hmm. And every year he would come out with the turkey list, which I frequently was on. And I was so mad about that because his definition of what's a turkey is what was not in the governor's presented budget. It's the same kind of analogy of you just made of just because the governor didn't put it in his budget
right. Doesn't
mean that the legislators in Pinellas County didn't have some good ideas. And I always thought it was rather a lazy way of deciding what's a turkey and what's not, because the process is supposed to work. And legislators are supposed to represent their constituents, whether it's for an appropriation for a performing arts center, whether it's for a road project. That's one reason we elect them.
Right.
And I always thought that was a really kind of lazy way, because once you're labeled a turkey, it does get harder. I mean, Dominic was right. But you had to then make your arguments even stronger to the governor's staff about why projects should not be vetoed.
Right. And I think that, you know, having to process information as a legislator has only gotten harder because of the proliferation of information, proliferation of expertise, and the advanced skill of putting that in front of you. And a lot of times it's the consequences of not adhering to it publicly, like even, you know, the turkey list is now more powerful and pervasive than ever.
I think it's tough, and I have great sympathy for the legislators who just, when folks come up from home, they're always happy to see everybody. Mm-hmm. And I've been with, you know, many of the, we lovingly call you day trippers, the folks who come up for a day and they get frustrated that they can't see the speaker or the chair because they're from home.
Right.
But those people are busy, and it's not just busy to be busy. They are doing work because it's a 60-day session. So I always try to encourage folks, if they want to talk to legislators, find them at home. And also, you know, you should not be meeting them for the first time when you come to Tallahassee for your 4-hour visit to the Capitol.
Right. I want to expand on the theme of the turkey list. Those things are hard, and they are an injustice, and that is just one of potentially endless examples of that sort of manipulation of information. And you know, like you mentioned, you could be doing brilliant things, and because information is so limited, when placed on the list, kind of hoses you for a lot. So, what were your strategies for dealing with the inevitability that you can't please everybody?
And you can't please everybody. I think that some of it is every year also has a different context. So last year, so many good projects got vetoed by the governor because we were just entering COVID. Mm-hmm. And how do you complain about that? And I encourage folks last year not to complain about it, that it's just a reality. Each year has a different opportunity for funding. Different sectors have kind of good years and bad years.
Right.
So I think that you have to really contextualize it all, and that every year is not going to be the space for workforce, or every year is not going to be the space for preservation of land. So I think that there's some recognition of all the nuances of the process. I think ideally, to have the governor include you in a budget always helps. So the work begins there. One of the questions I was always asked is, so like, what do you do after session?
Right.
And the work has just begun, because it is to maintain these relationships and to understand whether it's the university or the Board of County Commissioners or the mayor's office needs for next year. That work begins immediately, as does the relationships and the continuation of the relationships.
And as I've mentioned, a few of these, potentially annoying things. I wish we were on the video, because you're smiling a lot. At each turn, you've come back to me with, it makes the job a little harder, or people don't appreciate these other folks. And at no point did you say, this makes me angry, or this hurt my feelings. And it didn't even seem like it flickered across your eyes as you were answering it. So, is that just an ultimate pragmatism, job first, don't take it personal? Where does that play into your personal fortitude that you're here and able to just roll with that?
So I confess, there are some projects I care so deeply about, and then it hurts. Years ago, with probably my proudest accomplishment legislatively, was giving the authority to the Board of County Commissioners to fund the indigent health care tax. It was really tough, lost one year for a renewal. And it's pretty unbelievable, because that is probably the last surtax that does not have a time limit on it. So it was before all of that. It only took a simple majority of the Board of County Commissioners. So in the arc of my career, then it went to, you had to have a supermajority to pass a tax increase at the local level. Now you essentially just can't do it, but it's very, very hard. So I think that those projects, when I'm so clear of the difference it would make.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not in that case with indigent health care surtax that I necessarily knew my neighbor would benefit. Because my neighbor probably wouldn't benefit. I was living in a lovely condo on Bayshore. That's probably not the target market. But the impact of providing health care to people who needed it was so profound to me. Again, proud daughter of social workers, I knew it would make a difference. So that one, you just ache. But what you do is you come back and you figure out the better coalition. You figure out what legislators care or don't care, and what the work is. And so it's a motivating factor. It's never in the appropriations process, which is what so much universities are about. I had some very, very good years, thanks to our delegation members. And everybody says, oh, that was terrific. You must be happy. And it's just like, well, no, I'd be happy if I'd gotten $10 million more. So you're never done. So I think there is also a difference between some of the policy issues and the appropriations. Candidly, most folks just say thank you and that's great. But when you lose or you don't come home with money, folks are disappointed, and they don't know the context. They don't know 5 great years doesn't mean the next year is going to be great. So some of it's understanding that people don't really know how it works. But my guess is that's true for how to build a bridge or how to, other things. But for sure, some losses hurt more than others. My favorite story is of when I worked for the Board of County Commissioners, the president of the Senate happened to have a small, small contract. I'm being facetious. He represented one of the big rental car companies. And the Board of County Commissioners, my work, which I take seriously, was to pass a tax to increase the rental car tax. And it didn't matter that everybody in Hillsborough County wanted it. And it was for, I think that project may have been for the Bucks. I can't quite remember. But it didn't matter because that bill wasn't going to get heard. So that one actually didn't hurt that much because from the beginning I said, it's not going to happen. So sometimes they don't hurt at all. But sometimes they hurt big. And then you just got to remember that some of big initiatives take 2 or 3 years to get done and not to give up.
And I guess in that specific example where I would have felt the grr of injustice is that it wasn't heard, but you've seen enough of that, that that's just the way things roll.
Yeah, it's called power.
Yeah. And as you look back, you spoke a little bit of the dutifulness with which you did your job up when you were up in Clearwater. And you know, as you progressed in your career, either did you expand, you know, let yourself get into things that drove more personal passion in you, or even would I say looking back, do you wish you would have done that sooner or done it more?
I think life is kind of a balance beam. So I think that I had lots of ability to coach and support folks who are working on issues that were not mine, of just suggesting how I might do something while staying really focused on that which I was being, you know, paid to represent. So I think there are ways of helping folks on those issues that we're really passionate about. And I think that in my private life, I got to write the checks to the people I wanted to write them to or organizations that I wanted to write them to. Again, coming back to my family, it was always about giving back, whether it was time or when you had the resources to do that. So that was just just following my parents' footsteps.
And you know, following the thread of writing checks, you and Katie are huge supporters of the arts.
We are.
Let's talk about art in St. Pete a little bit. How are we doing? Where are we going? What do you think?
So Katie is actually the visionary in the family, and we don't fight very, very infrequently do we fight. But we fought because she came home and told me that unbeknownst to me, she had moved her art space and she was in love. And I said, oh, did you sign a contract? Oh, yeah. How long would that be? Oh, a year. So that was a fight. But she was so correct and I was so wrong. That was the Arts Exchange, her first space there. She then graduated to a 3,000 square foot space, for which we did talk about before she signed a 3-year contract. But she had the vision specifically for the Arts Exchange of what an important driver that was going to be, what the combination, the synergy of the different artists, the fact that it provides some safe space, meaning it's not going to get priced out. But before that, Katie came to town and led the Morion and understood from her New York experience in economic development that arts is an economic driver. These days, I don't think that's particularly fresh here.
Right.
But when we came, it was. And I think she understood the economic impact of a thriving arts community. And I'm so proud that she really helped create it. With the Arts Exchange, we were proud to be one of the major funders of the Arts Exchange as it was getting going. And there's so much pride when we go and the work that's been done there, full parking lots pre-COVID, but it's coming back. And that whole energy, I think, the fact that the fairgrounds is coming, all of these projects. But going back, you know, really got to give the shout out to Mayor Baker. He invested public dollars in parts of the community, and then the private sector comes in. So I think that that is so important. I think what Liz Dimmitt is doing, so first we start with the Arts Exchange, which is subsidized, has all these different spaces. And now you have the project that Liz and others are doing that are so important, and it's private sector.
Right.
You know, and I think that's the role of economic development in the public sector, to plant it and then make sure all the environment is right to thrive. And the Warehouse Arts District is just an extraordinary space. Now people come to town to see it.
Yep.
And that the artists are making a go of it and change in our community. I just think it's extraordinary. We also support the orchestra. We are a big, big supporter of the Holocaust Museum, where I was on the board for many years. So it's a diverse range, but I also think that's a sign of a pretty sophisticated city that we can have such a range of museums, some downtown compact area, others now with the Arts Exchange and the Warehouse Arts District blossoming a bit off the grid. And there's more coming. I think it's enormously exciting and just fun.
You know, you have, a good awareness of placemaking and the value of placemaking. I mean, there's never an end to the road, but you know, obviously we're already seeing gentrification conversations come up, you know, with the marina and let's get bigger boats in, let's keep the smaller boats and affordable housing versus higher end housing. And, you know, there is a cycle to art that tends to be, you know, done in the garages and studios to done in the nicer studios and nicer garages to eventually it brings in money, which brings gentrification. So, you know, how, because I will say you mentioned the, you know, the cap on the rental price of the, so what do you
I think these are such important questions, just not for the arts, but for downtown. When I started to work for Mayor Baker, you remember the landscape, it looked very, very different. Beach Drive was dead, right?
Yeah.
And in a moment of humility, Mayor Baker used to say, you know, we're a 20-year overnight success. Because before I joined his administration, there had been lots of attempts. So I think that now, you know, we're in this surge. But I think that not just about arts, but all about development, you know, I think there's something to be said for curated development.
Right.
And I think that this administration is really trying to tackle that as far as what's good, how do we keep local, what's too big, will we push folks out if we have more condos and more traffic? I have a hard time believing that. Only in my lobbying career, I got to know so many different parts of Florida. And we are such a good deal to other parts of the state. And as our prices rise, so do theirs. So I think that there's got to continue to be a thoughtful conversation about keeping St. Pete special.
Right.
And we also have to change. For the gentrification, it's something that Katie and I talk about a bunch. And I think it's such a double-edged sword. So proud of the development, so proud of kind of community engagement. And we have to take care of the whole cloth. And I think how we do that, some of that is public dollars, community interventions, and some of it is the private sector. I'm pretty happy that I keep hearing that more. I think the new expression is workforce housing.
Workforce housing, yep.
Is coming.
Yes, it is.
And I think that that's so critical for what I think, you know, are the folks who are making our community better by being teachers,
yep.
By being firefighters, by being cops, candidly, by being assistant professors who are not paid much. You know, I mean, I just think that intellectual capital. So I think that the workforce housing and the incentives or the commitments that the public sector can help to begin to provide that.
Yeah.
We want these folks to stay.
Yeah.
You know, what happens at USF frequently is that the assistant faculty member, they can stay in a condo, he or she, until they get married, and then they want kids. And then what we found is that they're moving to Manatee, making the commute. So that's a loss for them of time, but it's a loss for us because then how am I going to ask them to be on a local board?
Right.
Because they want to cross the bridge and get home.
Right.
So I think there's so much about the gestalt of why we want folks to be safe in their housing and can afford it. You know, I think it's one of the top issues that a lot of smart folks are working on, but we've got to start practicing it.
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioned the 20-year overnight success, and I've been hearing about the St. Pete Renaissance for forever, right? To the point where I got, I won't say frustrated, but I thought, what does that mean? You know, and so we actually started a series on St. Pete 2.0. When do we become St. Pete 2.0? And exploring that, the answer I came to was hopefully never, you know, because the Renaissance is the beautiful time. It is the time when we're on the come, or, you know, we're getting there. And the closer we get there, you know, really what I see from the people who are making the get there happen is a resistance to getting there because, you know, this is the nice time. And some of those cycles are just inevitable. But I think the short answer is to really appreciate the time we're in and to prolong it as long as we can. But I think there's still a lot of, with progressive developers, and there's a lot of good areas to put that workforce housing still. We're not to the point where that's totally price prohibitive.
I don't think so either. And I think there are, you know, progressive developers, they're certainly going to want to make some money. But I also think that, again, kind of the public sector help or some tax incentive, something to put these pieces together. And as far as change, when I left Mayor Baker's office to join Katie in New York, and I worked at a community college called LaGuardia Community College in Western Queens. And Queens continues to remake itself. And it's, you know, New York does as a whole, but I can't speak to all of that. But, you know, I had a walking tour by one of the historians of Queens, and, you know, it was the old Jewish deli area that was owned by a Korean. Mm. It was the bakery that was Lithuanian, but that now is run by the Chinese. I mean, it's just this whole iteration. Queens is the most diverse county in the country, or it was when I left a few years ago. Everybody comes in, and so it is wildly diverse. And so some of the, you know, the names of the stores and their product lines stay the same, but the people change and the investment change, and then the housing changes. So all to say is we're always changing. And I think that there has to be some recognition of our possible different roles. I do think that, you know, more jobs in different sectors here in St. Pete is helpful. I think we're more than a suburb to Tampa.
Right.
But how to nurture that is really, really significant. And we just have the assets to put it together. But the iterations, I think, will continue and continue. I think it's a strength. And I say that until, you know, something happens that I don't like. Then I'm grumpy. But I think it really is. It's not atypical for a thriving place. The alternative is to be stagnant. And we did that for a lot of years.
Sure.
We did that for a lot of years. I think one of the other challenges is as people find us, mm-hmm. how do we connect them in the community? Mm-hmm. You know, I've had this conversation with so many folks. Folks come, they discover us, but then how do they become, you know, part of our community? And how do they give here, not just financially, but their support or their network? And I don't know if any of us have cracked that well. I think you guys start to do that, but it is still, you know, it's almost some curation of new relationships to get folks plugged in. And I don't think there's a systematic way to do it. Maybe it is just bumping into folks at Kawa and then starting a conversation and then introducing them to 12 people you know.
Well, you know, just because you brought it up, yeah. You know, the Catalyst, you know, as I envision it, is just on the first step of its journey. And I'd love to build those tools, sort of the picks and shovels for those connections to happen. And, you know, I see a world where we give a newspaper tool to every high school, and we give a newsletter tool to every neighborhood association. Every writer who's passionate about a topic, you know, can use our newsletter tools to, or our, you know, subscription tools to write, put their content out there. And then you kind of put a fence around it and call it a community. And, you know, as the 11th grader writes a really great piece at high school A, you know, it bumps up to the high school page and all the best writing from our high schools are there. And if one of those really excels, it bumps up to maybe our daily edition. But then all the folks who care about startups or about Lake Maggiore's, you know, ecosystem or about Coast Hawaii Hazard or whatever, they can all, you know, have a place to express their content. And that's why we started the Catalyst, to solve exactly that problem, that idea meritocracy meets connection. You know, we just have a lot of silos. Even locally, we have a lot of silos. And I think mixing ideas is the way to solve that.
The political world, we call that communities of interest. So as we start reapportionment next year, in the old days, it used to be, you know, how you could draw the lines. Well, if there was a community of interest.
Right.
But I think sometimes we get so segmented that if you're, you know, a person who is into the environmental issues or the marine science issues, that, you know, we don't think to cross them over to arts and culture.
Sure. Yeah,
and it's not quite that straightforward, but I do worry about the segmentation. But also, if I was coming to town, you know, I'd probably look up arts and culture first. You know, so I think that it's so tricky. The good news is there's a lot of content out there. The bad news is there's a lot of content out there. And I want to make sure people are still, for me, old school, talking.
Right,
and seeing each other and bumping into folks and starting conversations. And I think that the tools really, really help. And you know, creating places where folks can connect. Because I think that if folks can connect in St. Pete, then it'll be more than just a place, their second house or even their first house to live and to, you know, leave for other places, but to actually settle here and then contribute.
Words to live by. So I'd be remiss, you know, you've been in the room where so much has happened and your experiences and your memories are so valuable. So, you know, I'd like to just cover a couple phases of your life and what you remember, and just for folks who have lived through St. Pete. So let's just start, you know, your first foray kind of into St. Pete with working with Mayor Baker. You know, how did that start, and you know, what sticks out as your time there?
My good friend Steve Seibert, who has returned to St. Pete after being in Tallahassee for lots of years, was a county commissioner. He actually introduced me to Rick. I think we're at a conference together. I think Rick needed a ride home. Anyway, we ended up in a car together. And, you know, after I had not spent any time in St. Pete, I was a South Tampa gal working for the Board of County Commissioners. And Tish Elston, who was his strong right hand, had worked in Hillsborough County as well. And was there, part of the Baker plan was education. Mm-hmm. And I came over early one morning, and folks who know Rick won't be surprised to know it was a very long conversation, wide-ranging, but he had the clarity of what he wanted to accomplish. And this was a guy, I used Rick as an example of folks who come to St. Pete and, you know, they show up, they do what they say they're going to do, and they become leaders. For Rick, he was, you know, a new attorney, came up, ended up, you know, running, being the chair of the chamber, and then that launched his career. But he spent 15 or 20 years engaging, and he really had thought a lot about how to transform the city. No secret, he's a serious Republican, and I am seriously not, and at the time, even more so. But what we could agree on is the opportunity. And so the first initiative with him was to create Mayors, Mentors, and More. And that was his commitment to get kids college scholarships, but more than that, to do what, as a social worker, I would call wraparound services. So how can we help them? And how can we also help the principals? How can we help the school? So it was a systems approach. And that program went on to win awards. Mayor was very engaged in helping raise the money for the scholarships, which we used for sixth graders, and then they had to make a commitment. That was a big, big initiative. And I think he was right. It was absolutely Rick's vision to start with middle school, because he said, those are tough years.
Yep.
But it was a great, great way for me to learn the community. I think it was maybe my second day on the job, Deputy Mayor Goliath Davis said, you're coming with me. Go, who remains one of my most important and dearest friends, took me to every middle school that I was going to be implementing the mayor's vision. He introduced me to every principal who he knew well and just kind of gave me the stamp of approval. I remember getting back in the car with Goliath, and he'd said a million nice things about me, and this was day two. He said, how'd you know that stuff? He's still a police chief. He just looked at me and said, oh, I just made a few phone calls to folks in Hillsborough. Classic go. But I think his support and his understanding of certainly the schools that were struggling really helped me. I think being in the mayor's office gave me that catbird seat of meeting the important folks. Mm-hmm. And for that, I'm always, always grateful to Mayor Baker for that opportunity. It was started out as a school's initiative, and then the mayor kept asking me to take on some additional responsibilities. And ultimately, my portfolio was pretty big. It included lobbying after 9/11. The city's longtime lobbyist, Herb Paulson, was called up to active duty. And so the one thing I had wanted to get away from was lobbying, and my friends just laughed because I was back in the mix.
And, you know, given that you had political differences, you're on different sides of the spectrum then, did you find that your interactions were really tied more deeply to specific programs, or did you develop a more general mix of conversation?
Yeah, so all my friends, it kind of raised their eyebrows, but I think for Rick and I, it wasn't an issue. You know, local government, and I'm not a purist and I'm not naive, but it's a nonpartisan office.
Right.
We had lots and lots of work to get done. And so it really did not come up. Again, he was my client, and I understood that the places where we were going to have differences, they didn't really impact our daily life. So I think that more times than not, it was easy. And I was not the only Democrat in his administration. So we sometimes on occasion would double team him. But I think that it was really about moving things forward in lots. I mean, he was very serious about having a seamless community. Mm. I don't think we've gotten there, but the investment that he made in Midtown was really extraordinary. I remember being at a meeting with the president of Johns Hopkins, not of the medical school, but of the actual president of Johns Hopkins, who's a Canadian guy. We're all in one of the big conference rooms, and Rick was doing his spiel, and the guy, president, just interrupted him and said, excuse me, Mayor, I must have gotten wrong information. I was told you were a Republican. Rick kind of blustered a little bit and said, I am a Republican, but you're doing so many good things.
Right, right.
And you care about so many different kinds of things. Are you sure? And he was just playful, but it was in that very dry Canadian kind of delivery. But I think that Rick was genuine about caring about different parts of the community and demonstrating it. And that way, it was great to work in that administration.
And when you look at, I mean, now that you have endless, you know, on-the-ground data about other mayors in other cities or whatnot, but it feels like your takeaway was that he was very authentically connected to the community, you know, having Goliath there. And that, you know, driving you around to the schools and, you know, that, I don't know, I don't want to call it throwback, but, you know, is that a fair statement?
You know, I think in his time, it wasn't about social media and campaigns. Rick, you know, spent time in Midtown before the election. You know, their rap always is that the candidates always come to the black churches 3 weeks or 4 weeks before the, that wasn't the case. I could walk with Rick in Midtown and everybody would know him. Of course, he was 6'7" and I'm 5 feet. So we kind of made a funny, you know, couple walking the streets, but people knew him. They knew him in all parts of the town. So he's a very active, energetic guy at the time. And he was really known. And again, I think it was before social media was quite as potent as it was.
Right.
But he's a hard worker and he was out in the community and he knew most parts of it pretty darn well.
That damn social media. So we'll take a break from gathering institutional knowledge to talk about love.
Yeah.
You decided to make the jump out of Baker's administration and out of Florida altogether for love. Tell us about that.
So it was one of the funniest moments. I went in to see Mayor Baker. First, I had lunch with Tish Elston, who is a dear friend and an extraordinary leader in this community. We were walking back to City Hall and I said, oh, I'm going to see the mayor in an hour. Oh, what, you know, what's on your mind? I said, well, I'm going to resign. And it was kind of a showstopper. And Tish said, why is that? And I said, I'm going to join Katie in New York. It's time. This long distance stuff doesn't work for us. And she said, will you give me a month? And I said, well, I have to quote my very good friend. I can wrap everything up in 2 weeks because that's what Tish asked me to do when I left Hillsborough County and gave me a very serious talk about, really, you can wrap anything up in 2 weeks, Helen. So Tish sent me off with love and just said, oh, mayor's going to have a bad afternoon. So I walked in and the mayor looked at me and said, I don't have time for bad news today because I don't have a very good poker face. I said, oh, it's not bad news for you. It's definitely not bad news for me. And I told him I was leaving, and he said, why? And while he is very astute at many things, he had failed to understand that Katie was coming. We were traveling back and forth, and that she was really the love of my life. So I said, I'm going for Katie. And it was one of the few times when Mayor Baker was quiet. So off I went, and I think that it was, you know, an extraordinary, you know, I said that it was, you know, I was moving for the love of my life, and that was true. And my time in St. Pete was so special. When Katie and I were leaving New York a few years later, it was really come here or come to Tallahassee, where her family and some of my family were at the time. And St. Pete absolutely won out because we had spent so much time here and it's such a special place. So I think it was a bit of a surprise to Mayor Baker that I would leave his administration, but I saw it through, I think through year three, I think he had already, I think he was about to announce for re-election.
Right.
So it was just fun. Katie and I have known each other since we were kids in Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. We lived on different parts of town. I was in the poor faculty section, and she was not, but her dad was a very successful developer. But we shared the geography of lots of different places, of places. Tallahassee was so small then. I think maybe, well, when my parents got to FSU in 1953, I think it was 13,000 students. So it was tiny, but we have that shared geography of loving North Florida as well. So went to New York, had a grand time there. Katie's career was really rocketing, and I had the great experience of working in Queens for a community college with another visionary leader. So it was a really, really good run, and I was really ready to come home.
Sure. And how did Katie come to be in New York?
Katie came to New York. She was there about 15 years. And she, too, followed someone and made a career there after a really successful career at East Carolina University. She was doing economic development. She worked in Lower Manhattan.
Right.
And did a tremendous amount of work there.
So this was your initial coming together then. So you were a completely distant relationship from
day one. Yeah, we actually had our first chapter when we were in our 20s. I say we were young and dumb.
Got it. Okay.
And we were. And she says we went and worked out on neuroses on other people.
Yeah.
And then when she was getting ready to celebrate her 50th birthday, she came and found me. So it was our second chapter, which is much easier and better than the first one when we were young and dumb. So it's a magical story. We feel so lucky to have the second chapter. I visited with Katie 2 weeks before 9/11. And I knew enough, though I'd been traveling to New York, it's my favorite city, but I didn't know it, her part of the city that well. But I knew enough after visiting with her 2 weeks before 9/11 that her office was near World Trade Center. And actually, it was maybe my 11th day on the job working for Mayor Baker when 9/11. And I sat with Mayor Baker as the second tower was hit. And all I could think of was Katie's safe. And indeed, she was at the World Trade Center during 9/11. And it's one of our many miracles that she survived. So for that, I'm grateful. And it really energized me when Mayor Baker said, you got to go lobby for us. And it was just thinking, Katie lived, other people lived, there's so much work to be done, we've got to make this world safer.
Sure.
And I'm happy to go to Tallahassee, and a lot of the lobbying was about security money back then, but it was very, very personal for me.
Understood. It's a beautiful story. All right, so back to our regularly scheduled institution download, and this is the one I'm ready for, the down and dirty consolidation.
It's definitely a dirty word.
You know, obviously, you were there, so just I'm just going to let you riff.
Yeah, so I think consolidation was a surprise to many of us. I'm not saying it was a surprise to everyone. I don't know what our colleagues in Tampa knew. It's a, you know, as we talk about, things continue to change. Certainly, the story of consolidation is not yet done. I think the decision to consolidate was the priority, one of the priorities for now, Speaker Sprouse. And that he is another guy we haven't spoken of much in this interview, but he is extraordinarily smart, energetic. He doesn't do anything casually and has been a very, very good friend to me and continues to be. I think that what the speaker really believed is that all parts of the university needed to be stellar. And that his belief in consolidation was that it would distribute some of the resources and some of the intellectual capital that a university, particularly a research one university, can offer a community. And, you know, that was his driving force, was towards excellence. And I think that that was difficult for people on every campus. So it wasn't just USF St. Pete. It was also USF Tampa. It was Sarasota Manatee. Probably the folks that stayed the most neutral, least impacted, was USF Health. But the other major parts of the organization, you know, it has ramifications for everyone. No one was happy, you know, and depending upon truly where you sat on that one is how you ended up feeling. It was clear to me because throughout my career, one of the things I am really, really good at is understanding power. And I understood that the Pinellas delegation wanted this to happen. At that point, representing my client, it was how can I be as protective as I can for USF St. Pete? So the original bill filed was quite different than the bill that was passed. The Downtown Partnership weighed in really heavily about how, if it's going to happen, here are some ways to protect the campus, to protect the community. So a larger campus board, some focus on what programs were going to be achieved here. I think one of the things we all agree on, regardless of where we sit, is that marine science is so critical to that community and to the economic development community of the city. So we were able to make some changes. I think that, you know, this past session, there is some, you know, funding that will continue the rise to preeminence. There'll be some other resources. And I think it's still in the early stages of coming to fruition. I think that the business community is critical to continuing to speak for the campus. And I think that the campus board is now an advisory board, but having the right people on that board to advocate for the campus and to make the connections will remain critical.
So as you sort of introduced it, if I just kind of recount, you mentioned that it was driven mainly by one sort of person and that no one else was happy about it. And then you mentioned the word power. So let's, you know, on the romantic side of that, I can see, you know, a visionary who saw something and people don't like change, you know, but then on, you know, having been more ingrained in the St. Pete side and really seeing nobody happy with it on the St. Pete side, let's take the thread of that power versus vision and then real effect in real lives, how would one reconcile that if, as we sit here?
I actually think it's pretty easy to reconcile. Every good idea you know, starts with a champion in the legislature. Mm-hmm. I would have Chris Sprouls be my champion for any issue that's important to me because he works hard. And while he certainly owns that he was one of the driving forces of it, he had the whole delegation supporting him.
Right.
He had people in the education space, in the legislative arena, supporting him. So I think that he absolutely was one of the driving forces of it. I think by then he was already speaker designate. So I think that people recognize that. But it's a persuasive argument that there should be quality in all places. And you asked earlier about, you know, are there things that hurt or are painful? You know, I think that this was a consolidation became a very personal issue here. I think that folks, you know, really were disappointed in the outcome. But I also think it's really too early. So you say nobody's happy with consolidation. Nobody's happy with consolidation yet.
Yep.
I do think that this notion of strengthening our marine science, having undergraduate programs feed it, mm-hmm. I think there are all sorts of good things, strengthening things that will happen. I think that some of that is about accountability.
Right.
And I think, again, the business community particularly has to continue to hold all of us accountable of the programs that are supposed to come here that were thoughtfully designed or thoughtfully named. And it wasn't out of context. So if you read the law, it's supposed to be about some of our tech. It's supposed to be about marine science. And it's supposed to be about arts and culture.
Right.
So I think that some of those programs really resonate here. So the roadmap is there. So now we have to have the focus, and again, to persevere
right.
about reminding our policymakers who, again, with term limits change, but why these programs make some sense. And I think that that's critical. So I think that it's a long game, but I think that there are some pluses and minuses to it that will continue to emerge. I think that if I was folks in Tampa, I think if students come here, they actually don't want to go to the Tampa setting, you know, unless they really want football or they really want Greek life. But I think that as more students come to discover USF St. Pete as a campus,
sure,
it is wildly different. And I think that more and more students will discover it. Certainly our residence hall, you know, it's almost the same view that you have, Joe, of, you know, just such beauty and the class size. So I think that this will create more choice.
Sure.
And I remain optimistic, though I have many bruises, but I still think that what Speaker Sprouls envisioned with the right follow-up and tenacity will benefit the city.
And your mention of yet was what will lead into my follow-up thought is that, you know, there's a lot of roots here in, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell, I mean, probably a little harsh way to say it, but the weeds from the flowers, right? And I mean, we have a lot of legacy institutions, you know, in and out of the university, in and out of the public sector, private sector, neighborhood sector that, you know, could use some innovation. And there's always going to be resistance to that.
You know, I think that higher ed is another whole space that's just changing.
Yeah.
And coming out of COVID, you know, I'm very curious to see what remains or what how this past year impacts the whole delivery of higher education. We're all into long-distance learning, but it wasn't a mandate. Mm-hmm. I think our faculty members at USF St. Pete, and my assumption is universities and colleges across the nation, got so much better about creating community online. Mm-hmm. And there's all these different techniques. There's all these different pedagogies now. So I think that that will really change things. But I do think if you look at the long arc of USF St. Pete, and my staff ran the celebration of its 50th anniversary. It's been a lot of different things. It used to just be, you know, junior and senior. You know, we didn't lose that. We were still undergraduate. You can still come to this campus. And again, it is a separate kind of experience. I think the faculty and staff who are drawn here kind of fit the gestalt of St. Pete. I don't think that goes away. I do think that there's some areas of excellence that are just natural for us. And that gets stronger and stronger with time. And again, only with diligence and expression of support from the private sector will that aspiration be reached. But I don't think there's anything wrong with aspirations. And I think that folks are still, you know, have some angst over the process. But that's in the rearview mirror. The object is to go forward. And how do we get energy around that? How do we understand that the support is for this campus because it's so critical. you know, it's a little trite, but, you know, every great city has a great university. And we certainly need that, particularly as other parts of our community just continue to blossom.
Wonderful. And whatever greatness our little university here has is in no small part to you. So thank you for that.
Well, that's kind and generous, but thank you.
Helen Veen, thanks for joining me.
You bet.